Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the just-released report from the UN Commission of Inquiry, mandated by the UN's Human Rights Council, that urges the international community to act on evidence that crimes against humanity are state policy in North Korea and that the country's leaders should face justice for unspeakable atrocities. Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University and author of Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990, joins us to discuss North Korea's systemic use of torture, starvation and execution that the UN report compares to Nazi-era atrocities. Then Daniel Webster, the lead author of a new report in the Journal of Urban Health that provides compelling evidence of how the repeal of Missouri's background check law has led to an increase in the state's gun violence and murder rates, joins us. He is a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, and we will discuss his report and what kind of national strategies gun control advocates can adopt in the face of dedicated and well-financed opposition. Then finally, we will speak with Gareth Porter, an independent investigative journalist and historian who specializes in U.S. national security policy, about his latest book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of Iran's Nuclear Scare, and the impact of evidence about Iran's alleged nuclear activities that was provided by the MEK. We will look into the key role that this shadowy, cult-like group of Iranian exiles has played in promoting the military option and urging war with Iran, and how they spread a lot of money around Washington, buying a pantheon of prominent bipartisan political clout that recently succeeded in having the MEK removed from the State Department's terrorist list. And joining us now is Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korea Revolution, 1945 to 1950, a history of the peninsula titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Armstrong.
Good to be with you.
And this report that's just come out from the UN in Geneva, it's devastating. It's basically saying that the North Korean security chiefs and the supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, should face international justice for ordering the systemic torture, starvation, and execution, which they compare to Nazi-era atrocities. And this is an official UN report that's been in the works for some time. I believe the UN contacted Kim Jong-un to let him know about this report. So let's start with the report itself. I've never heard anything quite so devastating as this, have you?
No, this is the most critical, indeed devastating, as you say, report the UN has ever produced on any country. And it lists in great detail, hair-raising detail, atrocities committed at every level, from the top of the leadership to the prison guards to the mid-level bureaucrats. It is really quite extraordinary. None of this by itself, each individual item, is not terribly surprising. We've known about this for years, all of us who have looked at North Korea, but to put it all together in this way is quite astonishing.
So some of the details of women being forced to drown their own babies, children imprisoned from birth and starved to death, families, children informing on their parents who are subsequently executed, families being tortured for watching soap operas. I take it these are soap operas that are smuggled in from South Korea.
Yes, that's correct.
And isn't that the Achilles heel of this regime, that the people who live in this kind of Orwellian bubble of propaganda, ubiquitous propaganda, once they hear about how the people in the South are living, who they're told are living under the yoke of Yankee imperialism, it kind of unhinges them. Is that why the regime is behaving in such a brutal way?
Well, seeing the reality or even the kind of TV dramatization of life in South Korea does undermine the propaganda of the regime for the North Koreans who view it, and we've gotten to the point, this has been going on for over a decade, that North Koreans are able to view smuggled videos from South Korea. It was originally, you know, through VHS and then DVD, but now you can put something on a flash drive and it's pretty difficult to detect. So we're seeing this more and more. The question is, however, how can this translate into any real opposition to the regime? Because as the report details quite explicitly, the surveillance, the security apparatus, the oppression of people's ability to speak out and organize is still very severe. So even if people are becoming increasingly skeptical of the official line, it's still very, very difficult to translate that attitude into any opposition or any criticism overtly.
But also for a communist state, it's a devastating report because it talks about this, essentially this aristocratic structure of the where the elites live in fortress-like privilege, and the rest of the people are, are starving. Of course, there's always been that paradox that this is a communist dynasty, the Kim family dynasty. So are our definitions of it in terms of the left and the right skewed? Because I've heard from Korean scholars who've suggested that it's really not a communist country so much as it's more accurate to compare it to, say, Japan in the 1930s and 40s under the imperial Japanese ruling dynasty.
Well, I'd like to see where a real communist country has ever been actually put together, because I don't think we've ever seen one, at least not one that lasted any length of time, where people were really equal, despite all the ideology to the contrary. I'm going back to Stalin's Soviet Union, which was still a place in which there were elite privileges and many people living in misery. North Korea has always been a very hierarchical society, and this report goes back, as the report points out, this goes back to the very beginning of the regime, in which people were classified according to class background. So it reversed the traditional hierarchy. So now you had children of landlords at the bottom and children of workers at the top, but that's become a self-sustaining kind of social caste system. I think actually George Orwell put it best in 1984 when he says, there have always been the high, the middle, and the low, no matter what system has been in place. And that's certainly what we see in North Korea.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Armstrong, who's a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. So there's also the issue, apparently, which the UN report, I believe the authors of the report in Geneva, this is the UN Human Rights Council, contacted the Chinese ambassador in Switzerland, or to the UN, and complained about repatriation of North Korean defectors and smugglers who go into China. And if they're repatriated forced back into North Korea, they're summarily executed. So let's talk about that relationship, because obviously when it comes down to referring the regime's leaders, as this report suggests, to the International Criminal Court, China is likely to veto it.
Yes, I think that's probably true. And the real question here is not what has gone on and what goes on in North Korea, because I think we are all more or less aware that the human rights situation is utterly abysmal. The question is, how can this lead to any serious action? And as long as China continues to protect North Korea for its own reasons of what they think of as their self-interest, their national interest, it's very unlikely that there can be any international action to address human rights. The Chinese government has said that North Koreans who enter China illegally are doing so for economic reasons, and they said that to the UN Commission on Human Rights in their letter last December. And they are not interested in directing criticism about human rights to North Korea, at least not overtly. It may be that behind the scenes, the Chinese would like North Korea to tone down some of what they're doing, but they're not likely to hand Kim Jong-un over to the International Criminal Court anytime soon.
So is there a reign of terror going on, as some reports have indicated, in North Korea? We know that there was the very public execution of the number two man in the regime, Kim Jong-un's uncle, and that was done in a very graphic and humiliating way.
and subsequent reports indicated that it may had a lot to do with control over some lucrative enterprises that the uncle controlled and that the son had ordered back into the control of the army, I believe, and the uncle had slow walked that, and the petulant new boy emperor, as he's referred to, had a sort of tantrum and offed his uncle. I mean, that's the, you know, there's a sort of Alice in Wonderland Mad Queen aspect to this that may or may not be true. So give me your version of what you think's happening there.
Well, I don't think there's a reign of terror going on at the general level any worse than there has been before. I think that at the top of the leadership, there has been a shakeup going on ever since Kim Jong-un came to power more than a year ago, and it seems to reach its climax with the humiliation and execution of his uncle by marriage, Chang Song-taek, in December. So if you are associated with the old regime of Kim Jong-un's father, then you should be very afraid of what might happen to you. It seems to indicate that there are people who are opposed to Kim Jong-un's assumption of power, or at least Kim Jong-un and those around him think there are such people. And we haven't seen much since the execution of Chang Song-taek. That might have sent the message that Kim Jong-un wanted, and he has been very careful to say that the policies of the regime towards China and so forth remain the same. So it really is about, it seems, a power grab and pushing out the old guard and those associated with Chang Song-taek and put into place by Kim Jong-un's father. It's pretty gruesome. It's worse than anything we saw under Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il. And we have to see whether that can be contained within this leadership, and it reflects really Kim Jong-un consolidating control, or if it's going to spill into a wider instability and a terror like we saw in the old days of Stalin in the 30s. So far, things seem to be reasonably stable, but we just have to see how it all plays out.
But Charles Armstrong, one of the many aspects of this report, apart from the documentation of systemic torture, execution, and these ubiquitous gulags that they have, it also singles out the state, quoting the report, has used food as a means to control over the population and deliberately block foreign aid for ideological reasons, causing the death of hundreds of thousands of people. So what's the logic there of that?
Well, it has to be kept in mind that although it was quite a brutal regime for a long time, things got much worse in the 1990s after the Soviet Union collapsed and North Korea's main economic lifelines were severed. The economic situation became catastrophic, and there was a famine in the late 90s. And since that time, food has been very scarce, and the regime has regulated the flow of food to people in order to keep the population politically in line. And certainly, there's lots of evidence that the authorities, including the military and the government, have blocked or directed food aid to the places they wanted to go. And, for example, keeping the military fed is more of a priority than keeping the population in the remote areas fed. There are places where misdirection of food aid has been worse in famine situations in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, for example. But North Korea has been a food aid recipient for now 20 years, and food has become a very powerful weapon in the hands of the regime.
So what is then the response of the donors? What the donors must feel some complicity in, not that they have any control over what happens to the food. So, you know, I know that there have been complaints during the Bush administration of that the food is diverted to the army, and that therefore why should we be giving food for humanitarian reasons? So it seems like it's a real conundrum.
Yes, it is. Not all the food is diverted, and you have to keep in mind that the army in North Korea is an enormous institution that is itself very diverse, and many men have to be in the military for over 10 years. So keeping the army fed by itself is hard to separate from giving aid to the population in general. There have been efforts ever since the 90s to monitor food distribution carefully, and I think, I've been involved in some of that myself, that it is, in general, getting to the right people. There are, of course, exceptions. I think if we stopped food aid altogether, it would not help the situation. It would just make it worse. And it wouldn't be the case that the people on top would starve. The regime would make sure that those who they wanted to kept fed would be fed. It would just be that more people on the bottom would starve.
So when the this UN report on systemic atrocities or state policy in North Korea, which the UN report refers to as unspeakable atrocities and systemic use of torture and execution and starvation. This report also, you know, makes references to Nazi-era atrocities and also goes to the whole idea of all of the subsequent revelations that happened after at the end of World War II of the full scope of the Nazi atrocities and this whole idea of never again and the extent to which people in it turned a blind eye to what was happening and didn't want to know about it, and the whole idea of a kind of shame on the international conscience of the world. So here's this report saying we can't allow this to happen again. Here's the evidence. It's absolutely in front of our eyes, and we simply can't turn a blind eye.
Yes, that is the case. And, of course, Nazi Germany is the sine qua non of an atrocious regime. You know, I don't want to by any means downgrade the significance of what's happening in North Korea, but at least the regime is not systematically exterminating whole classes of people, although the way the Nazis did, although, of course, for many groups, things are quite grim. It is important that we know. It's important that this comes to the world's attention. But again, it's just not clear what can be done to move things forward. Having that knowledge is one thing. Actually being able to take action to address these issues is another question altogether. We've taken the first step. It's up to those in the West, in China, in South Korea, and elsewhere to try to work together to make the situation better. We don't know what will happen in the future. At the present, it doesn't look like there's much that can be done directly. But over time, you know, I think this regime will have to open up more, and these issues will have to be addressed directly.
So in terms of the issue of bursting the bubble of propaganda and via these smuggle videos and now flash drives, what is the is the trajectory of that in terms of how long can the surveillance state control this sort of Orwellian narrative that's breaking down? Because you know, you can't argue that you're in a workers' paradise when your people are starving, and you can't keep the rest of the world out, comparatively speaking, because life in South Korea is infinitely better, and that is the reverse of the narrative that they're told. So it would seem to me that inevitably, and with China right next door, right across the river that they sort of sneak across all the time, conditions there are so much better as well. It is a real sort of black hole, and it's amazing how they've survived as long as they have. What is then, in terms of the dynamic between whatever the glue that holds this regime together compared to the kind of subversive nature of the reality of the outside world?
Well, they can't continue this sort of control of the population and of information much longer. We are starting to see cracks and fraying of this whole myth that has kept the population in line for 65 years. But still, the surveillance state is very powerful. It's almost impossible for people to organize. And no one is going to invade North Korea from the outside. This is a country now with nuclear weapons, and any sort of military action would be catastrophic. What seems to be the most likely scenario is if things continue to fray at the edges and the situation becomes so much worse in terms of how people perceive themselves, that there may be a faction of the elite that breaks away and decides they have to do something, they have to take the country in a different direction. Of course, that's exactly what Kim Jong-un is so afraid of, and that's why his uncle was executed. But eventually, there are going, you know, if we can't have an uprising from below, which seems to be very unlikely, under the present circumstances. We could have some sort of struggle from within the top leadership by instigated by people who realize it is in their interest as elites to change things. Otherwise, they're going to go down with this sinking ship.
And, of course, by executing the uncle, Kim shattered the whole myth of this godlike dynastic family presiding over this country.
Yes, and the way he did that was very dangerous because they've had this propaganda for decades that this is an enlightened family running the country, and Kim Jong-un's uncle was presented as this sort of guardian. And if he suddenly is outed as a subversive and a traitor, how can people have trust in the rest of the family regime as well?
Well, Charles Armstrong, I thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Armstrong, who's a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with the author of a report that indicates how the gutting of gun control laws led directly to a spike in gun violence and murders. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Webster, Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he serves as Director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, Deputy Director of Research for the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence, and Director of the PhD Program in Health and Public Policy. He's the lead author of a new study in the Journal of Urban Health that provides evidence of how the repeal of Missouri's background check law has led to an increase in the state's gun violence and murder rates. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Webster.
Thanks for having me.
And you have provided evidence here of a direct connection between repealing what was called the Permit to Purchase, a law that verified a background check or that required a background check, and that since that repeal, which was urged by the local chapter of the National Rifle Association, there's been a 16% increase in the state's murder rate. Now, what's your sense then of the next step? Because it would seem to me that sometimes in our society, facts, evidence, rationality, and reason don't necessarily lead to results.
Well, if what you're saying, am I expecting Missouri lawmakers to go back and put the law back into place, I have to say I'm not expecting that to happen anytime soon. However, I do think that this is a very important piece of research that does demonstrate the benefit of reasonable measures to keep guns out of the wrong hands and to put more accountability into our gun laws, and that it leads to very meaningful differences in our murder rates. So I think that these findings will be very relevant to policymakers across the United States, whether those are at state level or hopefully at the federal level as well.
Well, apparently, even within the National Rifle Association, there's perhaps even a majority of its members who, like I think most Americans, if you polled them and asked them, are you in favor of criminals having access, easy access to guns, or mentally unstable people having easy access to guns? And they will say no. And that seems to be, but yet the leadership of the NRA has taken that organization in an extreme direction. So is there any way that you can reach out to the rank and file and circumvent the leadership?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think all of the surveys indicate basically what you just said, which is gun owners generally, and even NRA members, support very common sense measures like requiring background checks for all gun sales, which is not in step with the NRA's leadership and position on these matters. And I personally think that when more gun owners, in essence, voice their opinions on these subject matters is when we will see change. Right now, we're letting a very small portion of the American public and even a small portion of gun owners dictate important public policy that affects safety for us all.
And in terms of the divide between urban and rural in this country, my understanding is a lot of handguns that end up in murders in cities are purchased in rural areas and sometimes from the same gun store. There's apparently a notorious gun store in the suburbs of Chicago that supplied most of the guns for the incredibly out-of-control homicide rate in the inner city of Chicago. Is there any way to address that dynamic?
Yes, I think there is. First of all, I want to acknowledge that, yes, the dynamic of what you just described, that quite often the cities with the greatest rates of gun violence, the guns are not initially sold there. They're typically sold in nearby suburbs or in not very far off rural areas. Our own research has found that state and local licensing and oversight of gun dealers with regular inspections and even potentially undercover stings to make sure that people are doing what they're supposed to be doing in terms of how they're conducting background checks and keeping track of their guns so their employees don't walk away with them and sell them on the street and that kind of thing. We found in a number of studies that this has been very effective in reducing the diversion of guns to criminals. So this is a solvable problem, and most licensed gun dealers are law-abiding, good business people who we don't have to worry a great deal about, but it's the relatively small number who have the ability to literally put out hundreds of guns onto the streets, into the hands of criminals, if they're not adequately regulated and enforcement is monitoring what they're doing. So these are strategies that can lead to fewer incidents of gun violence and really have no impact on law-abiding gun owners' ability to purchase a gun. We're simply trying to put more accountability into the system, and that's generally the theme here, whether you're talking about permit to purchase, handgun licensing and background checks for all gun sales, or if you're talking about regulation and oversight of gun dealers. It all comes down to having the right laws that hold people accountable and enforcing them. And it doesn't have to be a big cultural debate across urban-rural divides about whether you like guns or you don't like guns, but let's just put in means of accountability that will make us all safer.
So in terms of this struggle between gun control and gun rights, as it's called, where clearly the people on the side of the gun rights issue, much better organized and quite passionate, almost to a religious degree, whereas those on the gun control side simply don't have that same kind of dedication. And I mean, recently, for example, after the Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, obviously there was an upsurge in concern for gun control. The president himself in the Democratic Party, who more or less had a hands-off policy when it came to guns, stepped into the arena and failed to even get any laws passed in the wake of the Sandy Hook shooting. But in terms of lobbying the state legislature in Connecticut, all of the big gun manufacturers in that state, where many of the leading gun manufacturers are, They let all of their workers off and had them go to the Capitol to lobby. So, you know, you don't have a level playing field. That's what my point is, I guess.
Well, you're absolutely correct. There's a lot more money on the side of protecting the status quo and keeping our gun laws relatively weak. On the other hand, I do think that Sandy Hook was a seminal moment, that there's far more energy and mobilization to strengthen our gun laws, to put more accountability into the system. And we shouldn't expect that's going to change overnight, the whole political dynamic. So my own view is that over the long term, the current dynamic that makes it very difficult to enact fairly modest measures like mandatory background checks, that we will get there. But in all likelihood, we will only get there if more gun owners, you know, voice their opinions, not the most radical group of on this subject.
But in terms of pushing the envelope in the other direction, in the so-called gun freedom or right to carry direction or concealed carry direction and the stand your ground direction, we have another Trayvon Martin type case now down in Florida where a man objected to loud music coming from a car at a gas station, went over and just pumped a bunch of bullets into this car full of black teenagers, killing one. He's now going to be convicted on lesser charges, but is there any chance that, I mean, it seems like you're fighting on so many fronts here. I don't know whether you should try and deal with more sensible states that where you can make incremental change or take on these states where the extreme libertarian attitudes exist. What's your sense of overall strategy?
I think that there are a lot of different kind of gun policies, and they're not all created equal. So things like right to carry laws and stand your ground laws are laws that, well, particularly right to carry laws, I think are particularly difficult to politically to address. There's not a consensus at all about that topic matter. I think, on the other hand, laws that are designed, in essence, to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people, whether we're talking about criminals, whether we're talking about underage youth, or people who, as a result of severe mental illness and other factors, might be have very dangerous behaviors, that there's pretty much across-the-board agreement that we should have measures to keep guns out of their hands. And most of those measures have relatively little impact on law-abiding gun owners, and that's why I have more confidence that we can make ground on those. And I actually also believe that it's those laws that are far more important in the broader scheme of public safety. The research that's been done, for example, on right to carry laws generally has found little or no impact of those laws, despite all the debates on either side. On one side, the claims are that, oh, as long as we make it easy for law-abiding citizens to carry guns, violent crime will plummet and we'll all be safer. On the other side, people were saying, oh, if we allow this, we'll have huge spikes in violent crime. Well, the data suggests that neither of those things have occurred. There might be a very modest increase in aggravated assault as a result of these laws. So we're spending a lot of time, passion on issues that are the most difficult to address politically and have the least impact on public safety. Whereas I think we should be focusing our energies on areas of agreement of keeping guns out of the wrong hands that research suggests will have the biggest impact on public safety.
Well, just in closing, given that there was actually gun control in the Wild West, and you wouldn't know that from Hollywood movies that have created this kind of myth of everybody having to pack six guns, etc. Mm-hmm. And every movie poster has somebody pointing a gun at you, and every television promo has these wispy young blonde women holding these big guns, you know. So what can be done here in Hollywood, I think, to stop this, you know, notion that the handgun solves all problems?
Well, to be honest with you, I sort of gave up on that line many years ago. I think it's difficult. You can't really control what happens in Hollywood. Hollywood will do whatever Hollywood thinks will sell the most. So I think on the prevention side, however, we can and should do everything we can to, in essence, deprogram people, and particularly youth, about, you know, what's reality and what truly is the movies, because I do think people create, you know, sort of fantasies about how it's so easy as long as you have your gun at the ready to ward off any potential danger or threat, that you'll be able to do that successfully, because you see it time and time and time again in the movies. And if you talk to people who do have any kind of experience in that in real life, say like law enforcement, they'll tell you that's very detached from reality.
Well, Daniel Webster, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Webster, who's a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he serves as director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, deputy director of research at the Center for Prevention of Youth Violence, and director of the PhD program in health and public policy. He is the lead author of a new study in the Journal of Urban Health that provides evidence of how the repeal of Missouri's background check law has led to an increase in the state's gun violence and murder rates. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the author of a new book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gareth Porter, who's an independent investigative journalist and historian who specializes in U.S. national security policy. He writes regularly for the Interpress Service and Salon.com, The Nation, American Prospect, Truth Out, and The Raw Story. He's also been published at The Huffington Post, Fire Dog Lake, Counterpunch, and many other websites. Gareth Porter was Saigon Bureau Chief for Dispatch News Service internationally in 1971, and he's the author of four books, including Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and The Road to War, and his latest, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gareth Porter.
Thanks very much, Ian. Glad to be on.
And your book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, of course, we've had the nuclear scare or the rumors of war now with Iran for a number of years. And at this point, there seems to be at least some sort of thaw underway. So let's begin with that. Do you believe that there is a thaw underway and even a possible strategic shift in the Middle East?
I think a strategic shift in the Middle East may be overstating it, and I'll explain why. Certainly, there is a possibility of an agreement on the nuclear issue, which is obviously extremely important. But beyond that, the Obama administration is still very much committed to a strategic view of the Middle East in which Iran is an adversary rather than even an objective sort of a potential ally or partner for the United States. And that's primarily because of the continued extremely close relationship between the United States and Israel, which is expressed in the continued commitment by the Obama administration to the idea that Iran is a terrorist state, an official state sponsor of terrorism, and a troublemaker, as they put it, in the Middle East. And those two, those twin charges against Iran are going to continue to dominate U.S. policy beyond the agreement, if there is one reached. And I don't think that there's a guarantee of that at this point.
But there's clearly a struggle going on within the U.S. government with the AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, having organized most of the Senate and the House to essentially sabotage this tentative agreement with Iran. And in turn, that push, which is pretty brazen, basically ends up with a defeat for AIPAC.
Well, it's true. They did get a black eye on the issue of trying to push additional sanctions in the Senate, in particular, at a time when it was clearly understood that that was going to be a tactic for sabotaging the negotiations with Iran on the nuclear issue and really pushing the United States toward military confrontation. And I think that was clearly a bridge too far for AIPAC. They did suffer a defeat. It makes them look less powerful than they had been in the past. But on the other hand, I think it's also still the case that AIPAC is capable of mobilizing the vast majority of both the House and the Senate to support those policy positions that AIPAC chooses to put forward, to push. So really, it's everything short of pushing the U.S. government into a direct military confrontation still appears to be within the grasp of AIPAC.
So tell us then about your new book that just come out, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, and in particular the role of the MEC, the Mujahideen al-Haq,
yes.
Who, by the way, speaking of lobbies in this country, they have the most ubiquitous and amazing lobby. They throw money around. I don't know where their money comes from because it's kind of an occult as far as I can tell.
Yes.
But, you know, they've got people like Howard Dean on their payroll, former governor of Pennsylvania, who's a popular guy on MSNBC. And then, of course, they've got a lot of conservative lawmakers as well. So they cover both sides. What is the source of their money, do you know?
I don't know the answer to that, but I think it is an extremely important question, which deserves a great deal of scrutiny by the news media, certainly far more than it has gotten thus far. And it is quite astonishing that the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the NCRI, National Council of Resistance in Iran, their political front, has been able to accomplish what they did indeed accomplish, which was to get off the list of terrorist organizations and to do so, as you've indicated, by essentially buying off an entire large group of very senior political figures in the United States. And there's certainly very serious questions about whether that was legal. They've gotten away with it, obviously, but it deserves, I think, to be much more carefully scrutinized, not only from a political point of view, but a legal point of view as well.
So why is it then that Iran has really taken such a hit over this nuclear issue, if indeed they don't have an active program? In other words,
right.
it's an act of amazing national sacrifice, supposedly on principle. Now, I understand from polling that the Iranian people actually really strongly believe in their sovereign right to nuclear power. But they are also don't like being isolated internationally, at least the young and the women and, the reformers that are backing the current president, as opposed to the conservatives who run the place and mostly have their support in the rural communities, not unlike the religious right in this country.
Right. You're absolutely correct that the Iranian people, by a clear and overwhelming majority, support the nuclear program on one hand. At the same time, they do not favor nuclear weapons. They never have favored nuclear weapons. And they believe that those two positions are entirely consistent. And that's because the Iranian government has, for a very long time, had a very clear policy that nuclear weapons, as chemical weapons before them during the Iran-Iraq War, as I point out in my book, are illicit under the idea of Islam, which a Shia jurisprudence practiced by the Iranian regime dictates. That is a very significant element in Iranian policy. Indeed, I argue in the book that if you look at the history of the issue, that this was indeed a decisive factor in the policy that Iran has adopted on weapons of mass destruction. It is simply not allowed under Islam, according to the Shia jurisprudence that they embrace. But this really comes back to your previous question, which I didn't have a chance to answer. The role of the Mujahideen Khalq in this entire political drama, and that is a key story that I tell in the book, and the story is that the Mujahideen Khalq were the actual source of the so-called laptop documents, which are now called the alleged studies, or were called alleged studies by the IAEA, and now termed the possible military dimensions of the Iranian nuclear program. They were the ones who gave the documents which have been used as the main evidence against Iran in terms of a so-called covert nuclear weapons program. They gave those documents to German intelligence, and I have in my book for the first time a detailed account by a senior former German Foreign Office official about his conversations with senior officials of the German intelligence agency in 2004, in which they talked about the fact that they got those documents from the Mujahideen Khalq, from a member of the Mujahideen Khalq, who was a sometime source of theirs. And they did not trust the person, and they were worried that the Bush administration was going to use those documents for the purpose of preparing a plan to go to war against Iran. And so they wanted to warn the Americans not to rely on those documents. And, of course, as happened in Iraq, the United States did exactly the opposite. It built a case on those documents, which is still the main evidence today that Iran had a nuclear weapons program.
Well, of course, that has echoes, ironically, of curveball.
It's a very clear parallel, which the German intelligence people were extremely acutely aware of
right. In
2004, and that's why they were so concerned. They were asking this Foreign Office official, whose name is Carsten Voigt, who went on the record with me to give this account in the book. They told him that they were worried that Colin Powell was now going to do the same thing. He was doing the same thing, relying on essentially, they didn't use the term, but an Iranian curveball to carry out a policy that they were afraid was going to be confrontation with Iran, just as he did with regard to the real curveball source in the case of the Iranian bioweapons labs.
The Iraqi bioweapons.
Iraqi bioweapons.
Yeah, curveball being this drunken Iraqi dissembler who the German intelligence had, and his ramblings became the basis of Bush's and Cheney's, Rice and Rumsfeld's justification for
that's exactly war, right.
War
so
against
I
Iraq.
Think what we have here is yet another major scandal about the misuse, the abuse of intelligence information. By the Bush administration, then passed on really to the Obama administration with regard to its policy toward Iran, which parallels that what occurred in the case of Iraq.
But then, Gareth Porter, how do you explain then the fact that the P5 plus one have piled on and gotten this agreement with Iran? You know, P5 plus one, that's Germany's the plus one, but you've got China and Russia in there who are certainly not cooperating with the U.S. on Syria, for example. So why did they cooperate against Iran in this P5+1 regime?
Well, I think it's a very complicated storyline, but one of the factors clearly is that all of the players in the P5+1, including Russia and China, were essentially taken in by the documents that the United States, the Bush administration, circulated to the IAEA and had the IAEA basically embrace over the years. I think they've succeeded in creating, and when I say they, I mean the neoconservatives, led by Ambassador John, well, later Ambassador John Bolton, during at least the first year of the strategy, but coordinated closely with the Israelis, they succeeded in essentially pulling the wool over the eyes of the international community on this issue. So, I mean, to really simplify the matter, I think that's what happened. I think there were various reasons why the Russians, for example, were willing to go along with this. They don't trust the Iranians. There's always been a matter of distrust between Iran and Russia, which goes both ways. And I think that played a role in the politics of this as well.
But China gets so much oil from Iran, and Iran has become totally, I mean, the consumer market, domestic market in Iran is totally dominated by Chinese products.
That's correct. And the Chinese do indeed have a stake in relations with Iran. On the other hand, I think the Chinese were much less willing to take the lead in diplomatically opposing the position of the United States and the Europeans on this than the Russians would have been. I think, you know, in on this issue, as is the case with many other issues, the Chinese tended to follow the lead of the Russians rather than to stake out a very independent position.
Well, you know, if your thesis is right, Gareth Porter, this is the only time that the neocons actually got anything right. Not that any, you know, are necessarily agreeing with it. I mean, they, you know, they lied us into the Iraq war, and their champion, of course, Chalabi, ended up being an Iranian asset all along. Iraq is now firmly in the hands of Iran. They are the world's greatest incompetence, as far as I can tell.
Yes.
And yet they managed to pull the wool over the Russians and the Chinese eyes.
Well, they did succeed in that, but of course they didn't get it right. I think they very dramatically got it wrong in the case of Iran, and I think that's the more underlying story that I tell in the book is how successive U.S. administrations, beginning with the George H.W. Bush administration, or even before that, the Reagan administration, have committed grievous errors in essentially rather casually trying to strangle the Iranian nuclear program when the program was clearly not aimed at a nuclear weapon and indeed not even aimed at acquiring an independent capability to enrich uranium. The Iranians originally were willing to depend on the French to do that for them, and so they would get fuel for their Bushehr reactor from French source. And the United States wouldn't even allow them to do that under the Reagan administration. And then the Bush administration began, that is George H.W. Bush, began a policy of trying to cut off all technological assistance to the Iranian program, which then quickly developed into a kind of overt suspicion of Iran as a potential nuclear power. And I think that that was way too aggressive and really had the effect of making the Iranians more nationalistic about the nuclear program than they would have been otherwise. And I think that's what we've seen play out over the last couple of decades.
But Gareth Porter, surely the other dimension to this star-crossed relationship between the U.S. and Iran is, I think, you know, the hostility, the mutual hostility. I mean, for how many decades have the Iranians been referring to America as the Satan, the evil, death to America? Death to America is chanted regularly, not so much now. And they held the U.S. hostages for 444 days. And, you know, it's been clearly a hostile relationship. And my assumption would be that all successive American presidents hate this regime and would love to do anything they could to topple it. And conversely, the theocratic regime in Iran has used anti-Americanism and anti-Israelism, if that's the right word, as a way to stimulate nationalism and hold on to power. So isn't that the dynamic that's at play here, that both sides have an interest in? The West wants to topple this regime, and this regime uses hostility from the West to justify its power.
Well, there's no question that that is an underlying dynamic that has played a very important role in the politics of this issue. I don't doubt that for a moment. But if you actually look more carefully at the year-to-year developments in both Iranian and U.S. policy, what you see is that there are some nuances there where it was really quite a close thing. Whether the United States and Iran would be able to begin to thaw, to move toward a détente of some sort under the George H.W. Bush administration. And that's because of the role that Iran played under President Rafsanjani in 1990-1991 in the release of U.S. hostages from Lebanon. And don't forget that President Bush had publicly pledged that he would reciprocate if the Iranians did, in fact, play a role in helping to release U.S. hostages from Lebanon, which they then did under Rafsanjani, with the understanding that there would be some reciprocal gesture that would obviously then lead or could lead to some warming of relations or at least some kind of thaw. But what happened instead was that the Cold War ended, and the Pentagon and the CIA were badly in need of something that would become the equivalent of the Soviet threat. And WMD, the threat of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, became the kind of the closest thing that they could point to a Soviet-type threat. And they played it up, and the CIA definitely tried to make that a centerpiece of their operations to appeal to Congress to continue to give them the kind of Cold War set of level of support that they'd gotten, and they were relatively successful in that. And that's part of the story I document for what happened, which was that the White House was put under pressure to drop the idea, in part by the neoconservatives Dick Cheney and the people in the Pentagon, who definitely wanted to have Iran as an adversary, not as a friend, in the future.
Well, of course, and then when the U.S. did invade Iraq, the Iranians came through an emissary to the White House and said, you know, we're ready to deal. They were afraid that they'd be next, and Dick Cheney said, we don't talk to evil, and shut the door on them.
So. That's right. That's another sort of historical turning point where it could have indeed gone in a different direction had perhaps there been a slightly different consciousness in the administration in Washington.
Well, Gareth Porter, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Gareth Porter, who's an independent investigative journalist and historian who specializes in U.S. national security policy. He writes regularly for Interpress Service and Salon.com, The Nation, The American Prospect, Truth Out, and Raw Story. He's also been published at The Huffington Post, Fire Dog Lake, Counterpunch, and many other websites. Gareth Porter was Saigon Bureau Chief for Dispatch News Service International in 1971 and is the author of four books, including Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and The Road to War, and his latest, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.